Welcome to Alpha Trader. Our guest this week is Jeff Kilberg. He's the founder and CEO of KKM Financial, a boutique asset management firm based in Chicago. Jeff, welcome back to Alpha Trader.
Aaron, great to be here, my friend. How are you?
Doing well. Great to have you back here. Obviously, we have a holiday shortened week this week. The jobs numbers on Friday. Maybe Joe Biden's going to introduce an infrastructure plan this week and a lot of discussion about those things. But first, we're talking here Monday morning, shortly after the open. And over the weekend, there was a lot of headlines and some nail biting over Archegos, which is a family office of Bill Wong. He was one of the Tiger Cubs, came out of Julian Robertson's shop. Apparently, the fund blew up on Friday. There were some big block trades that went off, and stocks like Viacom and Discovery got hammered on that. As we're sitting here today, it doesn't seem like the market, other than some of the bank stocks, cares that much. What can you tell us about Archegos and Bill Wong and what's happened there?
Well, it's amazing to see. And I think, you know, the acute volatility we've seen, and let's just rewind to the Reddy component when we saw what happened with Melvin Capital and the margin calls and being caught short. It's interesting to see how I think there's more sensitivity. So maybe there used to be a longer leash, Aaron, from some of these clearing firms on positions. But now when you see a fund to the extent that Bill Wong's, you know, I don't want to say blow up. I want to say head to close positions. And when you see that position closing, it's remarkable to see how well the marketplace actually digested. It was a notional of $35 billion being moved. But this all kind of really feeds into the narrative of what we're seeing from a volatility perspective just underneath the surface. And that certainly has played into the fact that we're seeing the VIX higher, option premiums higher. But there's a lot of undercurrents that are making people a little bit anxious, a little bit nervous. But I am impressed to see the overall marketplace digest this type of move, but we'll be interested to see if there's going to be another shoe to drop, because let's remember, this is the end of the month and the end of the quarter this week. So if there's going to be anyone who's going to be asked to shore positions or to maybe to kind of window dress those balance sheets, it's going to happen today and tomorrow, and potentially Wednesday.
Ready, I was going to ask you about that as well. So, you know, again, Credit Suisse and Nomura have warned of the losses from the Archegos link sell-off or margin call. I'm not sure exactly what happened there. We really know, but what has been reported, and Bloomberg done a lot of the original reporting on this, is that much of the leverage was provided by banks through swaps, which meant that Archegos didn't have to disclose its holdings to regulators, and the positions were on the bank's balance sheets.
Right.
So financials have done well, you know, the last 6+ months. They've been, you know, them and energy and some of the other cyclical stocks have done very well here. As yields have risen, that's been good for the financials.
It has.
Is this a hiccup? Is this the hiccup for the banks, or would you be concerned if you were long financials here?
I think it's just a hiccup. If you peel back the onion a little bit here, Aaron, you look at Nomura, Japan's largest investment bank, right? They're talking about a potential $2 billion loss. That's more of a hiccup. $2 billion is a lot of money to us layman folk. But at the end of the day, to a big bank, a $2 billion loss is kind of a rounding error, if you will. And it'll be interesting to see if there is a subsequent component of someone else having a closed position, because they're just being more stringent on some of these large positions. And I think that's in the wake of what transpired with the Reddit trades, with the GameStop, with the AMC. But I do think that the shape of the curve, you know, I go back to my years, as you remember, in the 1990s and early 2000s, I had a floor operation on the Chicago Board of Trade, the CME group now, and I was a 10-year note futures trader. And always understanding and trading the shape of the curve, we've seen a dramatic move in the shape of the curve. And what does that mean? That actually means that we are seeing banks being able to profit. And when they can profit on this NIM, net interest margin, that obviously takes the banking sector, which was the second to worst sector in 2020, to being one of the best sectors this year, year to date. So we'll see how it shakes out here, but I'm still optimistic, enthusiastic on that. But what we've actually wanted to own, it's interesting, we run a lot of ETF model portfolios powered by NASDAQ, Dorsey, right? But we've seen the regional banks really light up the technical matrix for us. So we're wanting to own those regional banks. There's a lot of different ways you can own those regional banks. I know a lot of folks like KRE is the ETF. But I think the overall banking sector itself, Aaron, I think it's still rebounding and healing from what happened just a year ago. And if you think about where we were a year ago on some of these stocks, look at Bank of America, look at Morgan Stanley, look at the way they've recovered. So it's been a sensational move higher. But now I think it's time for a little bit of back and fill for the banking sector as they kind of digest where they were a year ago and where they are now.
And I would caution anybody who's considering selling banks on this news from over the weekend to remember the J.P. Morgan London Whale story. that turned out to be a great buying opportunity. Maybe not the day the story was released, maybe like a week or two later or a month or two later. But ultimately, the banks are going to trade, as you said, on kind of what's happening with the economy, what's happening with the yield curve. And as the economy recovers, the yield curve steepens a little bit more, rates go up a little bit more. That should be a positive on the banks. So
it's a great point. It's a great point. If you think about what do we continue to hear from Fed Chairman Powell every possible time they give him the microphone, it's this accommodative stance. They've certainly moved the goalposts on their inflation targets as they're kind of using the cost averaging of inflation to kind of help them get the economy to be hotter. But you're absolutely right. And I think that accommodative stance in conjunction with potential infrastructure, potential more spending, which we know is coming, that will play into the banks. But I think right now the banks are going to, at least investors in the bank, they potentially may book some profits. They may scratch their head just out of fear. There's been so much uncertainty in the last year. We've kind of become, most institutional investors, professional traders, we've become just a little bit more nervous about little things, because little things, sometimes when you pull on that thread, they unravel a little bit bigger.
Yeah, exactly. And we were somewhat half joking, you know, before we started rolling this recording, that, you know, this Archegos story and all the concerns about the banks, you know, maybe not that big of a deal for the market overall, at least on Monday, because yields are down. And is it that simple now? Like if the 10-year yield is falling, things are okay in equities. And if they're rising, you got to be worried, especially if you're in, you know, growth stocks and the more leveraged assets.
Well, it's almost become, you know, a little laughable about how we have a lot of newly anointed 10-year experts. You know, just turn on any TV channel and everyone, oh, and of course they can't even card up a one lot or even know what the tick value is in a 10-year. But the point that you bring up, I think, is fascinating. And as much anxiety, as much conversations we've had in the marketplace about the rising yields, I think it's important to understand, you know, when I started trading in the 90s, you know, the 10-year note was at 5.25%. We're never going back there, not at least in my lifetime. But I think when you talk about the relationship or the correlation, what is too much in the increase in yields, I think it's more of the velocity. And certainly the velocity took a little bit of the wind out of the sails. And that's why back in September, we saw some selling in the NASDAQ. And if you look at the NASDAQ 100 comparative to some of the industrial names, let's just call it the blue chip, you know, the Dow Jones in essence, we've seen a lot of assets rotate out. It's a reflation trade. And we're seeing a lot of industrial love and some of the laggards. Look at the 3Ms, look at the international papers, the waste management, the Boeing, some of these names that kind of got forgotten about in 2020. But I think what's interesting about the fact that the 10-year yield at 1.70%, which let's remember on March 23rd, the low of the S&P 500 in 2020, we did see the yield of the 10-year yield go to 31 basis points. That was fear. It was panic. They bought the living life out of the futures, which inversely brought the yields down to 31 basis points. And here we are 140 basis points higher. You think that we'd be back into our bunkers, open right up the cans of Spam and getting the bottles of water out. But nonetheless, the S&P 500 is above 3,900. We're 1% away from all-time highs. So I think the market is doing a great job of digesting that. And that's the heavy hand of the Fed. That's my perspective. That's my opinion, is that this accommodative stance, this balance sheet expansion, which will probably be above $10 trillion when it's all said and done, that's kind of quelling the nervousness. But there is some anxiety just underneath the marketplace.
I'm glad you mentioned kind of the speed of the move, because you always have to take these things in context. Like, we're at the 10-year yield as we're speaking is as 1.68%. A month ago, that was enough to freak the market out. Today, 1.68%, well, it seems kind of the right yield, you know,
that's right,
based on what the economy is doing. And if the economy continues to grow and yields continue to creep up and we're sitting here, you know, 6 months from now, 2.25%, that doesn't necessarily mean the end of the bull market. It might mean the continuation of it.
I agree. And I'm in the camp, and this is a lonely view, fellas, but I'm in the camp of the fact that we're going to see the 10-year note yield go back underneath 1.5%. And the reason for that is due to the fact that when you look at the other $18 trillion still in negative yields, you look at the $5 trillion in money market in cash, I think you're getting a little bit of a compelling reason to own that yield at 1.6, 1.7. So I think once we see this move really get digested, as we kind of see what's going on as the quarter wraps up here this week, I think you're going to see some buyers come back into the 10-year note, and that's going to bring those yields down. And that's actually what the Fed wants. And we have to remember, the marketplace, a lot of people are talking about 2%, 2.25%, like you just stated, but I don't think that happens this year. And why is that? Well, the Fed owns 1/3 of all the 10-year issuance. And if you own one-third of all 10-year issuance, you have the ability to control the long end of the curve. They haven't really brought or broken out the tool Operation Twist. A lot of the marketplace participants were looking for that Operation Twist rhetoric a couple of weeks ago when Fed Chairman Powell spoke, but you think he's holding that to see if we can get that test at 2%. But if you see a 2% 10-year, that will make him react, in my opinion, and that'll push yields lower. But I think we see yields come back down here as this all stabilizes and everyone digests this.
So if you're right about that, Jeff, and yields do come back down perhaps below 1.5% in the 10-year, would you expect the NDX to outperform in that in the next, you know, I don't know if you're talking about it in next week or the next couple of months, what time period you're talking about, would you expect growth stocks and the big mega cap tech stocks that have lagged to regain some of their leadership?
I think they will stabilize. But if we look at the fact that what we've seen over the last couple of years, going back to 2019, 2020, that leadership, but it's more about the leadership and the weighting. And if you look at the S&P 500, for example, right, the top 10 stocks are these NASDAQ names we talk about all the time, these FANG stocks. Those top 10 stocks in the S&P 500, they represent 28% of the S&P 500. The next 10 stocks, which is a little bit more industrial, you talk about Home Depot, you talk about JP Morgan as a bank, those next 10 stocks only represent 7.5% of the S&P 500. So I think the rotation, the profit taking from that phenomenal trade of being overly heavy or tilted to the FANG stocks, I think that certainly is going to transpire and continue to move forward from a reflationary trade perspective. But we're not going to abandon the FANG stocks. We own them actually in our Essential 40 portfolio. We own them in an equal weighted manner. For the first time, I think equal weight ownership is going to make a difference as market cap weight is obviously, you know, kicked the tail of everyone in 2018, 19, and 20.
And just to be clear, you see that the 10 long yields going down, not necessarily because the economy is going back into the tank, but because the Fed's going to be sitting on them and maybe because of the relative value versus, you know, what yields are globally.
I think we went too fast, too quickly, right? That move, you know, when the 10-year was trading, you know, it was kind of in a range there in 2020 and Q3, it was tethered to 90 bips. Then it kind of moved up, but it popped from 105 basically to 165. And I think that move caught a lot of people off sides. It had to reposition a lot of different books. But now as people reassess their exposure, a lot of people are simply walking away from fixed income. But on the other notion, you're going to see, and I think it was representative, and I'm getting a little wonky here, but if you look at the 10-year note auction at the CME Group 2 weeks ago, there was a significant increase in direct bidding, about a 15% uptick in direct bidding. And what does that mean, Jeff? Well, that means that some of these institutions, potentially, we don't know, but potentially like a Bank of Japan, they were more active in owning that 10-year note. So maybe they're rotating out of some of those negative yields into a it went off at 1.52 a couple of weeks ago, but maybe that's what we're seeing underneath the surface. And that's going to bring yields back down in my perspective.
Yeah, and Steve, and I got to give credit, makes this point all the time. It's like you look at yields in Spain and Greece and compare them to what the U.S. Treasury is yielding. And it's like, wait a minute, this is crazy stuff.
For sure.
Why wouldn't I put my money? I mean, you know, we have our problems here, but we're not Greece and we're not Spain.
And I think cats and dogs are going to live together once we kind of get yields to come back down. I think the S&P 500, the NASDAQ, the growth stocks, they move higher. And when you have, the amount of cash and liquidity being injected to the marketplace, I think it's just a 1-2 punch. And every time, an advisor, we work with a lot of financial advisors, a lot of family offices, everyone's waiting for a pullback. Well, they got the pullback in NASDAQ. Did they buy it? We'll see. But nonetheless, there's $5 trillion with a T that's sitting in cash, in money market funds. That's readily available data out there. If you look at $5 trillion sitting in cash, that's about half of what the Fed is going to do. And we know every $1 trillion, $2 trillion that they pump in, what does that do to GDP? What does that do to the stock market? So I think you just have to use that same metric or measurement to identify that, like it or not, agree with it or not, stocks are still the best asset class to own. You're seeing people be a little confused or a little apprehensive in some of the fixed income instruments. So that's why I think stocks move higher and yields move lower as well. So cats and dogs living together.
All right, we're talking with Jeff Kilberg, founder and CEO of KKM Financial. We'll be right back with more Alpha Trader.
And we're back with Jeff Kilberg of KKM Financial. Jeff, we'd be remiss. We need to ask every guest this nowadays that comes on Alpha Trader, but do you have any thoughts on Bitcoin, which is this morning back making another play at 60,000?
Well, Stephen, I do. And we actually have a partnership with Valkyrie, which is a digital asset company. So Bitcoin and digital assets have become more of an interest in the last couple of years for me personally. So I'm just fascinated to see the global adoption. I think everything that we thought about, we actually have a filing in. I can't really speak to the filing, but we do have a filing at KCAM Financial with the SEC. So we're excited about just the global adoption and where we are seeing Bitcoin. I was on Saturday Night Live. We saw them talking about NFTs over the weekend, right?
Right.
You're seeing people, you know, my dad wanted me to come and talk to his golf buddies and explain Bitcoin. So this is really fascinating to see. And I know at $58,000, $59,000, Bitcoin has changed and dynamic has changed. But when you see volumes increase at the CME Group in the futures now, you're seeing Ether, another futures contract being traded at the CME Group. I think there's a lot of interest out there. And one of the models that we run at KCAM Financial, we call it the Valkyrie Innovative Balance Sheet Model. That's focused on companies that are indirectly or directly owning Bitcoin on their balance sheet. And that universe right now, guys, that universe is about 50, 60 stocks. We see that universe of global companies owning Bitcoin or some form, some fashion. Think of Square, think of PayPal, think of Tesla. We see those, that universe of stocks going over 100 by the end of the year. So I think we've seen massive acceleration in the global adoption of cryptocurrency. And that's where I get excited.
So I'm glad you made that point that it's not just quote unquote MicroStrategy and Tesla, because those two seem to get much of the attention in the media, at least when Correct. It comes to having Bitcoin in your balance sheet. So this is a global phenomenon you're seeing in companies in all different kinds of industries. Is that true?
That's right. I mean, if you look at Domino's Pizza, there's a lot of different companies out there that are trying to wade into the water. Maybe they pay their employees with Bitcoin. Maybe they accept it. There's a variety of different approaches to indirectly or directly have that into that company. So that's where we get excited, because there's just a finite supply of Bitcoin. And is Bitcoin the actual blockchain solution for the end all be all of how we're going to live our lives? Probably not. But Bitcoin is first to market, and Bitcoin, like I said, is a finite supply. So this really gets interesting as we see. And I think there was a really interesting stat. I think it was there's 46 million millionaires in the United States. There's only 21 million Bitcoin. So think about that math. And I know I wasn't a math major at Notre Dame, but nonetheless, if everyone's owned one Bitcoin, we don't have enough Bitcoin for everyone to own just in the United States.
Right. And that's the whole point. It's a fixed supply and
are you guys still supply doing and demand. The math on that?
I'm still doing the math, but okay. Yeah, but
I got my
supply
sheet
and demand comes into effect there for sure. But you mentioned NFTs, and I felt, you know, this funny Steven saying we kind of have to ask guests about Bitcoin. I feel like we have to ask guests about the whole, I don't know what the word is, you know, the Bitcoin, the crypto NFT SPAC triangle. Which some people look at and say that's just evidence of crazy excess money and it's a bubble and we're all doomed and it's going to end badly. And you talked about the Fed earlier, and you know what, obviously we know what they're doing, what they've done. The big caveat I have to this is that in 1999, the 10-year was at 6%, and we're talking about it isn't going to get to 2.5%. But how are you concerned about some of the speculative excesses that seem to be bubbling up in these different areas?
For sure. I mean, I'm old enough now, I got enough gray hair where I've seen a lot of different cycles from the dot-com to the Great Recession. And yes, you have to have a little apprehension, but on the same notion, I think this is how, you know, more and more people get involved. And that's what volatility is all about. You know, volatility goes up and down. No one anticipated Bitcoin moving higher. And if we rewind, why is Bitcoin trading 58,000? My perspective is when PayPal came out last October, it was trading $12,000. And they stated that they were going to allow their 350 million users to utilize and transact in cryptocurrency, specifically Bitcoin as well. That was kind of the catalyst. And all of a sudden, you saw a lot of people get on board. And then the 1-2 punch here, fellas, is the fact that we are seeing Gensler, the new SEC chairman, come in, who has taught classes on Bitcoin and cryptocurrency. Right. So that adoption all of a sudden at the higher level, because everyone, as we know, you know, ETF, Bitcoin ETFs are allowed in Canada. And as we are part of a filing that has a Bitcoin ETF as well, it's interesting to see, will that be the next step for here domestically to allow more and more people? And if that Bitcoin ETF does come to fruition, I think there's about 8 or 9 different firms trying to file, and Fidelity just filed last week. But if that allows that broader active investor, retail investor adoption, I think, you know, the market continues to move higher in Bitcoin. The trajectory seems to be focused on 100,000, but there's no real like I can't pull up this on a chart and tell you, oh, you know, just like GE, you know, like there's resistance here. There's no real resistance if you see this global adoption really take off. But I think high tide lifts all boats. So, you know, if Bitcoin's gotten a little too expensive, which it has for some folks, maybe the CME group comes out with a micro Bitcoin contract. So it'd be in five coins, it's 1/10 the size. Maybe Ether, maybe Litecoin. Pick your coin. But I think high tide does lift all boats. But this global adoption definitely feels real to me. But yes, of course, there's reason to be concerned. And you could see a back and fill down to 42,000, you know, as fast as a shake of a lamb's tail, right?
Yeah, and that's Bitcoin has had in this run, say, from since the time PayPal announced to its current 58,000, there's been two or three 20 to 30% pullbacks during that run. So it's not like this has been a straight up move, although sometimes it feels like it. And yeah, I'm glad you mentioned kind of the mini contracts maybe being offered. I have a theory that if Bitcoin did a 1,000-for-1 split and it was 58 instead of 58,000, it wouldn't get nearly the kind of chatter that it does. I think people stop thinking in percentages and they get blown away by big numbers and they're like, oh my God, 58,000. But if it moved from 50 to 58, I don't think there would be nearly the amount of talk that you're seeing.
Yeah, that's a great point. I think Warren Buffett figured that out a long time ago A shares of Berkshire, yes. Right?
Right, exactly. And Jeff, I'm glad you mentioned volatility again. As we're talking here again Monday, mid-morning Eastern time, and the VIX is poking above 21 now. It's up 2.5% on the day. We had Steve Sosnick of Interactive Brokers here a couple of weeks ago talking about, you know, the out months of the VIX were, and to his mind, unusually high. And he was trying to think about what might be coming up. He thought it might be related to tax selling around tax day, which has now been pushed back since we spoke to him. So what are you seeing in the VIX futures right now? And how are you positioned vis-a-vis the volatility here?
So the VIX obviously is having a big day today. But what's interesting, and to kind of break it down, I think most people know this, but if you don't, it's okay. This is good to understand. A VIX of 16 is the implied volatility, the expectation that the market in the next 30 days is going to move up or down 1%. So 16 is that 1% move. But we've seen, you know, we rewind a year ago, while the VIX was at 80 or 90, the VIX was actually underpriced to the realized move we actually saw and endured in the marketplace when the market was moving 10, 12% to the downside and upside. It was just a wild type of volatility regime. But here we are now, we're not going back to the 2017 volatility component when the realized volatility, which of course is the S&P 500 daily moves, was less than 5. And then we saw the implied volatility even lower. So I think with implied volatility or expectations higher, I think that really presents a great opportunity. We do a lot of bespoke option overlay strategies, and we're finally getting paid on some of these option overlay strategies, which we typically didn't. But I think the VIX is going to continue to fluctuate between 20 and 30. Anxiety is high, and the more and more participants we get in, and the more we stay pegged up here in the S&P 500, as well as the Dow Jones, we're seeing these new all-time highs, and we know markets don't go up in a straight line. There's going to be a pullback. I think it's going to be healthy to see a back and fill, and that will certainly allow the VIX to move higher. So we like to have the ability to be nimble. We use a lot of VIX futures, upside calls, call spreads in the VIX. But that type of participation, I think going into the summer, is very different than the typical summer months that we're used to. I think there's going to be an opportunity for more and more realized volatility, which of course is in the wake or the shadow of the implied volatility. So we like having the ability to be nimble and owning volatility short term.
Right. And I asked you about a few months out, but how much, if any, of the recent move, maybe this today's move in the VIX, we're seeing is because the end of the quarter and the end of the month are right upon us?
It is. And I think, you know, whenever you see a Monday, there's the weekend effect that comes into the VIX. So that's important to understand. But I think the end of the month, a lot of people are looking at, what is the tax code telling us? Are there going to be additional taxes? Do we want to use some form of protection via VIX futures, VIX options to synthetically take profits? Or are you going to see people just buying more downside puts? All of this comes into the calculation. That's all the calculation is in the VIX, is helping better understand what people are willing to pay for puts and calls out on the strip. So I think you're absolutely right to talk about the VIX moving higher. I think it stays tethered into that 24, 25 level because You know, we were in a very different place a year ago when the VIX was back above 80. That was like great recession, and we actually went above 80, above 85, and stayed up there a lot longer than I think a lot of people anticipated. And all those short volatility traders who made just tons of money for all those years, they got put in the hurt locker when you tried shorting the VIX at 40 or 50. So I think the option market, which is increasingly growing, right? Let's look, last year they did 7.5 billion options. So all the Robinhood traders are trading options. We've seen that volume drift off a little bit, but I think all this option participation is helping the VIX move higher and stay higher.
Right. And you also mentioned, you know, tax regimes. And I referenced earlier at the beginning of this podcast, you know, that President Biden is expected to launch his infrastructure plan this week, and that's going to be paid for by higher taxes, much of it on wealthier individuals. There's some talk of transaction taxes for Wall Street, things of that nature. So that could, I would think that's in the mix here as well for the mix of the VIX. You know, sorry, bad rhyming.
No, you're right. And even before the election, when there's uncertainty going to election last November, we saw a lot of our family office clients trying to figure out what that tax code or that tax potential looks like. And there was some repositioning, there was some profit taking. And I think that's just going to accelerate this year. But you're absolutely right. The more money the government spends, it has to come from somewhere. I mean, that is simple math. So I think the tax code, what that looks like in the next year or two, it's going to be significant. Will capital gains for all the traders out there, will that change? It probably will. So I think you're going to see more and more volatility going in until we actually get something concrete out of the administration.
Brendan, Jeff, I just want to be clear about something, because, you know, earlier it sounded like you were pretty upbeat and optimistic about where the stock market is going, but you're also talking about the nervousness out there and a higher VIX. So, and obviously there's no one side trade, but how are you positioned here vis-a-vis US equities?
So we are optimistic on US equities in relation to the global marketplace. Emerging markets, international, has finally come back a little bit, but I think with where the dollar's positioned, where the Fed is supporting, I think the only real asset class to own from a global perspective continues to be U.S. equities. I think the rotation is real, moving their diminishing exposure to information tech, more into industrials. So we are short-term optimistic because of all the reasons I listed, but I am a trader. I come back to my days in the 90s and 2000 with my floor operation and understand markets don't move. It's not a linear component, right? So we are going to see some volatility. I think that's healthy for the marketplace, but with all this money kind of on the sideline, with all the liquidity being injected, the marketplace, if it does pull back 5-10%, it's a short-lived move. And we've seen this, and this isn't, you know, the typical buy the dip. This is just, we are seeing money needs to go to work. And where it's going to go to work, it's going to go to U.S. equities. So from that perspective, I can see the S&P 500 moving up another 5-10% before the year's over.
You mentioned you like regional banks earlier. Any other particular sectors or individual names that you can talk about?
Sure. No, in our sector model, we do have semiconductors, which are still number one from a relative strength perspective. We utilize a lot of relative strength, which helps us really rely upon the technicals. And of course, you shouldn't rely solely on the technicals, but this specific model helps us understand. And we also like software. So we're being a little more particular inside this tech umbrella. So software, think of Salesforce, think of some of these names, even like a Palo Alto Network, which focuses more on cybersecurity. But I think you have to be a little more discerning inside of your tech exposure. But we also like consumer services. And I think when you talk about consumer services, you have to understand that what we've done post-pandemic, I think that behavior, of course, it's going to revert to the mean. We're not going to be all running our Pelotons, all sitting on Zoom. But at the end of the day, the consumer services are going to continue to do well. So those are some of the top five sectors in our sector rotation model. But biotech is also nipping at number six.
And I just wanted to ask you one question about the dollar. Aaron and I like to joke that, you know, the guys from Chicago come on the show and they always talk about the dollar. They always have their kind of one eye on the dollar, no matter what they're doing. And you said the positioning of the dollar makes you bullish. Is there a level at which, say, the dollar's gone up too high and now, you know, now I'm kind of worried about Its strength versus other currencies, and it might make you a little more bearish on the markets?
Yeah, that's a great question. And where the dollar index, I always look at things, and this is the way I've always traded. I always look at where things have come from. If you're trading VIX, if you're trading euro currency, if you're trading dollar, if you're trading treasury futures, you have to understand where it's coming from. And we just came from testing 3-year and 5-year multi-lows in the dollar index. And now here, we're kind of kissing 93 right now. I do get a little concerned if we see the dollar index move back above 94, 95. But what's interesting about this global competitiveness, right? Every time you hear the ECB, the BOJ, there's always retaliatory consequences of our accommodative stance. So we did see the dollar index move lower, and that's a short-term, obviously, move higher for commodities and in emerging markets. And now we're kind of back into a regime where, as long as we stay under 94, 95, I think that's healthy for the marketplace. If we see a move back above to par, that's problematic for just about every asset class out there. So I go back to the conversation you brought up earlier and pointed out velocity. Let's watch the velocity of the US dollar, but as long as it slowly grinds higher and kind of takes a little bit of a breather at this 93 level, I think we're positioned well and optimistic about US equities.
All right, and as long as we're talking about the dollar and assets based in the dollar, we'd be remiss, I think, if I didn't ask you about crude oil. And I've seen various reports this, and again, we're talking Monday morning, that the Evergreen has been unstuck and then it got stuck again. But it looks like the Suez Canal is going to be open again for business. Crude oil is down about 0.5%, a little bit more now on that news, hovering above $60. What is your outlook, if you have one, on crude from here?
I think crude oil, it's really interesting. A lot of people thought it was tethered to $40, did not see the move higher, 50% move higher. But I think this is certainly OPEC and OPEC Plus needing the price of crude oil to move higher. All their budgets are predicated on higher crude prices. The Suez Canal, which has been fascinating to watch and is remarkable that it got stuck. But there's only about 1 million barrels of actual oil on and the 200 ships that are backed up right now, there's not that much oil really being. Of course, 15% of all global trade goes through the Suez Canal. So it's more of a consumer component. Maybe our toilet paper will be a little more expensive at some point in time. But I think crude oil continues to sit really tethered to $60. And I think that's going to be a little bit of short-term pain at the pump for a seasonality factor. And we have seen, RBOB gasoline certainly move higher from where it was a year ago. It's almost 3 times higher. But crude oil itself, I think, is positioned well. And as long as we see, and this is, I was kind of building up here. I was trying to give you a little build up here, fellas. But the real component of crude oil is going to be see what does the global demand, what does the global reopening trade truly look like? Are we going to see this pent-up demand? Are we going to see people really driving more, flying more, spending more? And if that is translated across the globe, crude oil will continue to move higher, but I think it does certainly have a cap, and a lot of folks will come back online to start producing more and more oil if we see it, stay above $60 or even $65. So short term, I think we're going to see a lot of back and fill in crude oil, but this is a positive economic signal. And I'm happy to pay an extra 40 cents at the gas station here in Chicago. But I think it's all going to be contingent upon what this global reopening trade really looks like.
All right. And finally, Jeff, before we wrap, it's great having you back on the program. We'll do it again soon, I hope. Gold. How do you explain this slow bleed drift down to just above 1700 as we're talking here today?
What's gold, right? I mean, it's amazing how for 2000 years, gold was the safe haven trade. Everyone loved gold. And even in that lower US dollar index conversation we had where it tested the multi-year lows of 3 and 5 year lows, gold didn't budge, did not move higher. And if that's the correlation, we should have seen, gold go back above 1900, but it didn't. And I think it's certainly a function of the fact that Bitcoin has come into the picture, and a lot of people are not buying gold. And maybe it's a component of inflation is not really on the horizon like we think it is. So you've seen just a lackluster interest of gold. I still think gold fits into the portfolio somewhere, somehow. But we look at our tactical model, and we owned gold in December of 2018. We owned it all the way till just about Labor Day last year, and technically it fell out of favor. So that was great timing from a technical perspective. But gold is the worst ranked In our tactical model, we have U.S. sectors, subsectors, and we have some commodities in there as well. The actual commodity index, silver and gold. Gold's ranked the worst from a technical perspective. So it is on the mat and can't get up. I don't know what the catalyst is to get it up, but right now we want nothing to do with it. And here's my 10-foot pole. I'm going to take 10 steps back.
So that's a 20-foot pole.
There you go.
Thanks to our guest, Jeff Gilberg. He's the founder and CEO of KKM Financial. You've been listening to AlphaTrader.
Thanks, Jeff.
Thanks a lot, Jeff.
Ton of fun. We'll talk to you soon. Be well.
Really appreciate it.